I'm here until Wednesday next week, as well as this stuff that I'm going to talk about today. I'm also working on some dark energy stuff with Doddy. I do some H1 intensity mapping stuff. I also do some Planck, Sunyaev Zeldovich stuff as well. So if you're interested in any of those things, just feel free to drop by. Because I'm a Planck member as well, I think I should just, you know, very quickly point out, someone brought up yesterday, you know, what's Planck's response going to be to these bicep 2 tensor mode results? So we are formulating a response. It's this. good luck, bicep 2. Okay. So today I'm going to talk about inhomogeneity. So we all know that the universe is, at least to some extent, inhomogeneous on some scales. You know, this is just your standard Sloan Digital Sky Survey Galaxy Redshift thing. It's obviously inhomogeneous. So question one I want to try and address is it statistically homogeneous? And the usual thinking is yes, of course it is. We have this statistically homogeneous perturbed Freeman-Robertson-Walker model that seems to fit everything really well. Just to refine this question a bit, I'm going to be asking, does it satisfy the cosmological principle on large scales? Okay, so we have this Freeman model. Can we make sure that it's the proper model? Can we really rigorously test that? And so, more to the point, even if it is statistically homogeneous, is it actually well described by a Freeman-Robertson-Walker model? Okay, so is our background physical model a sensible one? Does it sensibly describe the dynamics and the observations that you get in the real universe? Okay. Yeah. Sorry?
We can check homogeneity only indirectly. In order to check it directly, you have to go to a distant galaxy and check that scene is isotropic there.
Excellent. So wonderfully, you've preempted about 5 slides of my talk. So, excellent. We'll be talking about that very soon. Okay, so does this matter? I mean, we're kind of happy with these Freeman-Robertson-Walker models, right? They seem to give us something vaguely sensible, if you think lambda CDM is sensible, which, you know, maybe not. Does it matter? Well, yes. If the universe isn't, in fact, statistically homogeneous on some level, we're actually misinterpreting observations, so we're constructing the wrong model. And if it's not well described by a Freeman-Robertson-Walker model, well, that means we don't really understand its large-scale dynamics, and even more so, we don't understand its content. So these questions will become a bit clearer as we proceed. So to start off with, I'm going to talk about evidence, hard observational evidence for the cosmological principle. Okay? The key bit of evidence that, you know, people learn about in undergrad or whatever is that, well, the universe, as seen from our location, seems to be pretty isotropic. So we've looked at all manner of observables, things like the CMB. So here you see the COBE map. You see the monopole obviously dominates. It's got a reasonably large dipole, but we just explain that as being kinematical. And then, you know, these very small higher order, higher multiple anisotropies. You can do the same for radio sources, the galaxy distribution, that sort of thing. And everything looks broadly consistent with statistical isotropy about us. And of course, this naturally implies homogeneity, because what else would explain it? What else would give you those observations? So to phrase this more mathematically or more rigorously, you can use the Ehlers-Gerund-Sachs theorem. And this is just a statement that the isotropy of the CMB about a bunch of observers' world lines implies homogeneity. So here's the more exact statement. You have to assume things like the radiation is collisionless, for example. There's in the original theorem, there's some dependence on the exactness of the isotropy. So, you know, it can't be almost isotropic. It has to be exactly isotropic for this theorem to work. You also need things like, you know, you need no peculiar accelerations, that sort of thing. And you're reasonably restricted in the form of your stress energy tensor. I mean, this stuff should cover most things, but, you know, it doesn't cover everything. But the key point is that this only works if all of the observers in a region see totally isotropic observations of the CMB. We don't have access to all of those other observers, right? We're just one observer. And so we need to appeal to the Copernican principle. We just say, well, what we see is probably pretty much what everyone else sees. So this is a really key assumption of the Copernican principle. Now, of course, there are plenty of examples in the literature of spacetimes that are isotropic about a world line, but they're inhomogeneous as well. These are non-Copernican spacetimes. So it is possible to construct a relativistic model that, you know, would give us isotropy about our location, but which isn't actually homogeneous. Okay, so first question is, well, is this stable to perturbations? If it just relies on exactness, then, well, it's not really telling you anything at all about the real universe. So does almost isotropy of your observations imply almost homogeneity? The answer is almost. So there's this nice result by Stoger-Martens and Ellis from 1995. They find that the for small departures from isotropy, you can show that the departures from homogeneity are around the same order as well. So that's good. Almost isotropy does imply almost homogeneity, with a caveat. So as pointed out by Raisonen here, you need to assume that some space-time derivatives of things like the monopole temperature of the CMB are small. You have to assume that. It's hard to measure them. Raisonen argues that in the real universe, they aren't in fact small. Maybe debate that a little bit, but the point is we don't directly measure some of these derivatives. We can't directly say that they're small. And so you need to be rescued by the Copernican principle again, which is essentially saying that these spatial derivatives are small. So again, you've sort of assumed again.
You can say, okay, go test this, yeah, and we test that. So, okay, no, there could be that some that other possibility and test that. And then we, there are always things that, because of that, there are always things that you cannot test, right? So I'm not sure, but what is the end goal here? Because you can never prove that universe is a state. You can never prove anything in science.
No, and you can never prove it exactly. But the point is to put constraints on the alternatives.
So, okay. So then the question is, exactly, what is the alternative? Then?
Yeah, and so we'll get to that very shortly. And what we'll actually see is that some of the alternatives, as far as, you know, if you take a purely empirical view of things, some of the alternatives fit the data almost perfectly.
Okay, so that I think that's something that can be
predicted. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, we have to assume the Copernican principle all the time. Can we avoid it? Is there any way we can test the Copernican principle directly? It turns out there is. There is a way of doing this, but it's incredibly hard work. So what you actually need to do, this is a result due to Martins and some other people, you need to measure isotropic area distances, number counts, bulk peculiar velocities, and lensing. There are some conditions on the type of space-time this applies to, but it's vaguely realistic as well. You need to observe all of these things to be isotropic about your world line. That's quite a large sort of observational burden, because these bulk peculiar velocities don't just mean along the line of sight, the ones that we're used to measuring through effects like redshift space distortions, that sort of thing. This includes transverse velocities, which you can measure in principle, but no one's really done that yet, and it's very difficult. You need this all over the sky at all redshift. So, you know, there's a lot of information we don't have access to yet. Lensing, you only need shear, at least, but again, you know, at all redshift, all over the sky. So you need a lot of data to beat the Copernican principle in this way. How does it work? Well, the idea is all of these observables actually give you constraints on things like derivatives of your metric functions down the past light cone. And so you can use this to essentially construct a sort of Cauchy surface out of the your past light cone. And then you can use that, you can develop that inside your light cone, and so you know your full solution inside the past light cone. And as long as they satisfy this isotropy condition, well, you've proved that inside your light cone is Freeman, Robertson, Walker. Okay, so it is possible, you can do it. Obviously, we're nowhere near having actually done this, but there are hints, right? No one no one seriously believes, for example, that you know we don't have a statistically isotropic lensing signal, for example. But we haven't observed it, so there's wiggle room. So coming back to your question, are there any alternatives? I mean, this is relatively academic, right? I mean, sure, I think, you know, probably most people, I would guess, if pressed, would say, well, you know, the Copernican principle is probably true. Okay, are there any alternatives that actually match the data? Are there any viable models?
Are there papers which have tested the Copernican principle, like his main vessel,
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of people who work on this. So I'll talk about some of it right now. Okay, well, too far. So is there an alternative? Well, there is. So you can take some set of observables as a function of redshift, and you can sort of invert them onto some spherically symmetric space-time. Okay, so just imagine that we live in the middle. We want to, you know, we have access to some observables on our past light cone, and we want to sort of invert that back to some space-time, okay? And you can do this with these Lemaître-Thom and Bondi models. So these are spherically symmetric, dust-only models. You can select lambda to be zero, and there's this result due to Mustafa, Helleby, and Ellis, where they say, well, you know, for any halfway reasonable set of H of Z and DA of Z, you can just invert those observations back into some unique Lemaître-Thom and Bondi model, okay? So now you have this light cone degeneracy. You have a light cone that could equally well be described by a Freeman-Robertson-Walker model as an LTB model. So how do you select between them? So just for those of you who are not familiar with LTB models, yep, sure.
I always thought that the LTB models also have a time-dependent bank time.
Yep, that's true.
And so it's not over there?
No, it doesn't appear directly in the metric. It comes when you integrate your, well, the equivalent to the Friedman equation. The bank time appears there. You actually have three free functions of radius. One of them you can just remove by a coordinate transformation. So you actually have two free functions of radius. Okay, and that's all accounted for in this. So, okay, so I mean you can invert this data. You get some LTB model. Most of them tend to look like giant underdensity. Okay. Depends what you mean by outside the void.
So this universe is supposed to look like it's accelerating, but actually you're just inside some underdense region.
Yes,
so it's possible to make some sort of measurement of stuff that comes from the overdense region outside. And
sure, but you've got to remember you're always sort of constrained to be looking down your past light cone. And so by construction, that's degenerate with a Friedman model. So if you're just looking at things that are, say, a function of redshift, for example, it's going to be degenerate with the Friedman result. So I'm going to come very shortly to some things that you can do to break that degeneracy. Okay. But yeah, so the essential point is, if you live in the middle of an underdensity, you know, as photons come towards you, you think they're, you know, space-time is expanding faster in this region. So at late times, as the photon, you know, is just getting to you, compared to early times when the photon's outside the void and, you know, which it's matter dominated. Okay. And the interesting thing about these models is they can fit a bunch of data. So, I mean, I've only concentrated on two observables here, H of Z and DA of Z. But, I mean, you can get super close to pretty much any observation, but some caveats that I'll discuss shortly, that we already look at. So, I mean, this is just an example, you know, of fitting the CMB in a giant void. And there are tons of papers on this.
Assuming that you don't have lambda, but you have a void, right?
Exactly. And this is part of the motivation for them, right? So it's a completely relativistically conventional solution to the dark energy problem. Yeah. But I mean, well, what value should lambda have? So it's a way of trying to solve that issue. Okay. Okay. So, yeah, there are tons of papers, the one by Valkenburg that you mentioned, like loads of these things. But so you can just fit loads of data with these void models. Like really, almost all of the stuff that you'd want to fit with just a standard Friedman model. So this degeneracy is a problem, right? I mean, it's not just like, oh, well, they fit the supernova data, but other stuff goes wrong. I mean, they're really genuinely hard to distinguish purely observationally. So what, do you fall back on your priors or what?
AC or KC or something?
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. This is excellent. Everyone's like three slides ahead of me. It's wonderful. Yeah.
The CMD with a void, we need to be, there's a known result that we need not to be right in the center of the void, but slightly offset.
That's not strictly true. I mean, it depends on... So if you're off-center, what you mostly get is a dipole. Okay, the leading order anisotropic contribution is a dipole. And of course, we do see a dipole, but of course, in a void model as well, you could have some peculiar velocity too. So, I mean, that's not too much of a worry. The problem is more that we can't be too far off-center to fit the observations. So I think it depends on the exact void model that you look at and the data you constrain it with, but there have been a few papers on this. And in terms of the volume, sort of near the center that's allowable as a fraction of the total volume of the void, it's about 10 to the minus 8. So if you want to talk in terms of a fine-tuning, it's a fine-tuning of 1 in 10 to the 8. So you can see these are fine-tuned. We are fine-tuned to be near the center of these if it's to fit observations. But it's only 10 to the 8. Opinions on what counts as a big number may vary. Yeah. Okay. So how can we, observationally distinguish different light cones? Okay, rather than relying on assumptions like the Copernican principle. So as correctly anticipated by several of you, we can use scattering processes. And these, in some sense, allow us to probe inside the past light cone. This is why they're so useful. Okay, so if you imagine we're sitting here, this is our past light cone, this is a CMB or something, and then you have a mirror or some sort of scattering event here. Okay, and what this does is deflect light that would have otherwise sort of traveled way off our light cone, we would have never observed it. It deflects it back down our line of sight. And so now we can see radiation that was sort of destined not to get to us, radiation that started inside our past light cone. And of course, the state of this radiation is in some sense going to depend on what's happening inside the light cone. Okay, so you can see this at least gives us some sort of handle on figuring out what's going on inside. And of course, you could have maybe multiple scatterings. That's getting a bit difficult to observe, but we do at least observe first scatterings. That's very common. Talk about that very shortly. Okay. So, well, one example of this is the Sonnev-Zeldovich effect. Okay. The idea being that, say, you have some galaxy cluster. It's filled with very hot ionized gas. This gas, Compton up, scatters CMB photons. Okay. And these photons, some of them are scattered into our line of sight. Okay. There's also this kinetic SC effect, which, unlike the thermal SC effect, doesn't take the form of a spectral distortion. It just looks like a Doppler shift. In fact, it's actually, I don't know if you can see that, but it's normally taken to be sensitive to the dipole, the peculiar velocity of your cluster. So this is normally interpreted as a way of measuring peculiar velocities on very large scales. There's actually been the first detection of this by the ACT collaboration in cross-correlation with Galaxy Cluster Catalog. Huh? This is the only true detection that... Well... Ah, no, there's a... Yeah, I mean... I guess people will be talking about this bicep 2 result later in the week as well. But I mean, it's kind of similar size error bars. Okay. So that's not 7 sigma. anyway. So people claim to have detected this. So good, we can detect it. But we're not so interested in peculiar velocities here. What we're interested in is probing inhomogeneity. So you can reinterpret what the peculiar velocity actually means. So imagine you're sitting in a galaxy cluster, you transform to the rest frame of the cluster. Imagine that cluster has some peculiar velocity. Well, in the rest frame, you'd see a dipole on your CMB sky, right, due to that peculiar velocity. Well, that dipole doesn't have to have come from a peculiar velocity. It could have just been an intrinsic anisotropy in the CMB sky. If you live in an inhomogeneous universe, you're going to get an anisotropic CMB sky, a sort of a corollary to the Ehlers-Gerund-Sachs theorem. Okay, so this effect is sensitive to any dipole, doesn't matter where it came from. And so this gives us a handle on anisotropy due to large-scale inhomogeneity. Okay, so we can use the KSC effect to probe inhomogeneity. And people have done this. This is from my own paper with Tim Clifton and Pedro Ferreira. It turns out that in a void that fits supernova data from Union 2, HST H0 data, WMAP 7 CMB data, fits all those things beautifully, the KSC effect is constrained to be extremely, extremely large. So you can see here just the results of some MCMC chains. This is delta T over T of the KSC effect as a function of redshift of the scattering cluster. And come on, you see it's like 20% or something. That's not at all observed. These things are ruled out. So these giant void models as an explanation for dark energy are, you know, they're unworkable now. Okay. The discrepancy is so large that, I mean, the only thing that could really rescue it is if you had a very small void with a very low Hubble rate. So the Hubble rate does keep inching down as more and more data are released, but, you know, it'd need to be about, you know, 0.6, maybe lower.
I've actually never seen a constraint diagram, like, what is the constraint on the size of the void and, I guess, the under density of the void from KSC. So what is it really? So how small can it be?
So the point is, so with just the KSC alone, it turns out, and you know that the sort of available upper limits and the data we have, you can evade this constraint just from the KSC alone by having like a very wide but shallow void, for example, or you can have a very tiny void, like just a few tens of megaparsecs across. So you can evade KSC on its own. The important thing is to combine it with. Yeah. Yeah, so you start getting into conflict with things like CMB data.
But
once you...
Can we definitely say that we cannot replace, have no lambda and explain KSC at the same time? So that's
the statement. As long as you have other observables in there as well. Okay, so yeah, these large-scale inhomogeneous models with no lambda, they don't work. I mean, you could try and look at things with less symmetry. You have these Azekaris solutions, for example. Well, it depends on how you change it. So you're going to have to.
You change it in such a way such that light moves, so that the speed of light is anisotropic in directions and things like that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you really, really try and. I'm not desperate to say. I think, like, to do something like that would be. Yeah, that's kind of really pushing it by that point. I mean, of course, you can do it, but, you know, already, you know, we're out on a limb with this stuff. So, but anyway, so we can. The important point is not that giant voids do or don't work. The important point is that we can break this light cone degeneracy. Okay, we can go further. We can look at spectral distortions more generally. So, like I said, KSC is just a Doppler shift essentially, but in an anisotropic universe, a scatterer will also cause spectral distortions to be induced in the scattered light. So the way this works is relatively simple. Imagine you're sitting at this cluster or whatever again, and you're looking at an anisotropic sky. And in each direction, you just have blackbody radiation of some temperature, but the temperature is different at different points. So all of that radiation will come in, converge on you, the scatterer, and then will be scattered out back up the line of sight to the primary observer. And what the primary observer sees will be some superposition of all of those different black bodies. And you can show that the sum of black bodies of different temperatures is not a black body anymore. So if you expand around the sort of mean black body, this looks like distortions of that mean black body temperature. Okay, and so you can measure these. People do measure these, or well, actually just constrain them, put upper limits on them. As far as I'm aware, the tightest upper limits on spectral distortions are still from COBE. We haven't been able to really do anything more on these things with WMAP or Planck, but there's the planned PRISM mission in Europe that will probably launch around 2030 or something insane that should be able to measure these as well. There's another one called PIXI. I'm not really sure of the status of that. But anyway, we can measure these things. You can also learn interesting things about thermal processes in the, you know, before last scattering and stuff like that. So, but these things exist. And by considering these general spectral distortions, you can actually form a sort of alternative Ehlers-Gerund-Sachs theorem. The idea being that if you had any inhomogeneities in your universe whatsoever, an initially black body spectrum would get distorted somehow, okay, as it's scattered. And so if you measure a perfect black body CMB up to some assumptions, so for example, everywhere in the universe every event in space-time is capable of scattering light, which is pushing it already, and the initial CMB was pure black body, and also that you can detect photons that have been scattered at least twice, you have an alternative Ehlers-Gerund-Sachs theorem. So you can again see that, you know, the data you actually need to really rigorously constrain homogeneity, or at least test the Copernican principle, is, you know, it's hard, it's very difficult. But again, in principle, it's possible. Okay. And just to cap this off, I guess, it's not all about giant voids, right? I mean, that was just one example. Much more realistic are sort of local voids, much smaller voids that we do expect to be in the galaxy distribution. But these can cause problems, because just by living in a local void, you're sort of slightly altering things like your distance redshift relation. And so this can bias observations. So this is well known in the supernova community. You have this Hubble bubble effect, where sort of the local density field can distort their measurements. So they normally cut out supernova data below some redshift, which is 0.02 or something like that. Okay, but that's not enough for all observations, right? You do need to account for this, depending on, you know, what your locally inhomogeneous universe looks like. And so just a paper with Mark Kamienkowski here that showed that even a small local inhomogeneity, one that's actually consistent with what some people seem to be measuring is the size of our own local underdensity, can give you shifts in omega k of a similar order to the depth of this underdensity. And this is a problem if you want to use omega k to test inflation, for example. So we at least need to be aware of our locally inhomogeneous surroundings and the fact that it might cause corrections to our distance redshift relation and that sort of thing. You know, it tends to be on the sub-percent level. So I should just say these contours are omega k. This is the depth of your local inhomogeneity. This is its scale radius.
So that's the body, essentially?
Yeah, essentially.
Is that not a gauge?
Sure, but you can actually write out an expression in linear cosmological perturbation theory for the observable perturbation to the luminosity distance, and that's what's actually been tracked here. So this is an observable, and then we've converted that back into a sort of delta k around some reference model. So I guess, well, details in the paper, but yeah, the point is you can bias these results. So if you want to try and use omega k to test inflation, which might be possible soon with things like Euclid, we're expecting constraints around the few times 10 to the minus 4 level on omega k, you're probably going to need to worry about this. Okay, and just a couple more observables in a similar vein are the redshift drift. So this is a dz by dt, so the change in the redshift of some source as a function of cosmic time. The idea being you measure the redshift of a source, and then you measure the redshift of the source 10 years later, you see how much it's changed. This is actually quite sensitive to large-scale inhomogeneity as well. So maybe it's kind of hard to see, but... it depends on the redshift of the source you're looking at.
That's like happy big planets, right?
Yeah, sure. But I mean, it depends on the source you're looking at. Right?
But I mean, for any source.
Well, sure. But I guess you've got to remember as well that we do expect there to be things like local peculiar accelerations,
yeah,
due to the fact that, you know, planets are going around the sun or something. They're perturbed by a passing star, whatever.
Right.
So, and actually, those effects will probably swamp the cosmological signal.
Yeah.
This. So you need to look at stuff that's much further away to
try and
go around
that.
Yep. So this is actually a quasar spectra using an experiment called CODEX that will be on EELT. And they claim that they will be able to very stably measure the redshift of emission lines.
At the center of it.
People do look at this. I guess the plan would probably be to do this statistically. So you'd expect that to, on average, be incoherent.
Right.
You measure it for lots of quasars, and then, you know, if you find the mean, that should give you the cosmological signal. This is a really difficult measurement to make, but people are planning to do it. And it's neat because it gives you this kind of smoking gun signal of what I call a local acceleration. So an acceleration due to, say, a cosmological constant or a genuinely negative equation of state fluid, right? Well, W less than minus third. And in the accelerating phase, your redshift drift is positive. In a decelerating phase, it's negative. So if you can measure that, well, it tells you something as well. So these are, I mean, these are in kind of, this is, okay, it's at least 10 years using the CODEX experiment, at least 10 years. And that's really just for a detection. I mean, like, to actually put decent error bars on this, I mean, and there are so many technical challenges. So, you know, it's a difficult measurement. And it's made even more difficult because even if you had the best instrument in the world, you'd still have to wait quite a while for there to be any appreciable evolution. So it's difficult, but it's possible. And then you can also look at the growth rate as well, and this gives you a similar sort of thing. So obviously, if you have a universe that's accelerating, you get this suppression of growth at late times because your potentials are decaying. This doesn't necessarily happen. Or in fact, it doesn't happen in these inhomogeneous models with no local acceleration. So these guys looked at this, and you can rule out big, like vast swathes of these inhomogeneous models just on that basis. So large-scale inhomogeneity does not give us acceleration. In case you were worried that it did. Okay. So how much time do I have left? 15 minutes. Okay. Cool. So now I'm going to talk about, rather than the Copernican principle, a slightly more technical issue of, is Freeman-Robertson-Walker really a good description of a statistically homogeneous universe? So let's assume that the Copernican principle is fulfilled now. And the point is, it certainly seems to be. I mean, we have this ridiculously simple six-parameter model. You just need linear perturbations, maybe a bit of Newtonian gravity at very small scales, and it fits almost everything. Not absolutely everything. I'm sure people will have their own list of things to dispute, but you know, it fits beautifully. There's no problem, you know. So why go looking for problems? So we'll see shortly. There are ways of fooling yourself. Okay. So the question here is, you know that space-time isn't really Friedman-Robertson-Walker. It's some arbitrary, inhomogeneous metric that we don't know the exact solution of. But we want to try and make statements like, well, maybe it's somehow close to Friedman-Robertson-Walker. So we can use Friedman-Robertson-Walker as a background model, perturbatively expand around that, and get a good, faithful description of the real inhomogeneous universe. Okay, so we need some process that can give us a map between this real inhomogeneous space-time and this descriptive, representative homogeneous model. Okay. How do you average a space-time? This turns out to be kind of difficult. So most of the fundamental geometrical quantities that you might be interested in averaging are tensors. How do you average those covariantly? Most of the attempts to do this have relied on defining these just absolutely horrible additional tensor or bitensor fields that give you some way of parallel transporting stuff around in a covariant way. And a lot of them look kind of arbitrary. There are lots of problems with them. The canonical one to look at is by Zaletdinov. And you can just see what sort of horrendous trouble you get yourself into. So it's hard. It's hard to come up with a consistent way of averaging tensors. And even then, I mean, you know, really to describe space-time, this average space-time fulfilling the non-perfect cosmological principle, you actually only want spatial averages. I mean, you need time evolution in there as well. You can't just average out an entire space-time volume, right? You need to keep the time evolution in there as well. And so you can sort of see that, you know, maybe you're going to have problems. You're maybe going to have to choose some foliation. And that's going to be problematic as well, perhaps. But at least you can do something covariant, maybe, but you still have this ambiguous choice of foliation. So this brings on to back reaction. The idea being that if you look at the average metric, so you let's imagine we have some consistent averaging procedure that does everything we want it to do. We average the metric. Well, you can show that this doesn't necessarily have to turn out as giving you the corresponding average field equations. So if you separately average the field equations, it's not the same as the Einstein tensor on the left-hand side that you'd get from the average metric. So weird, what's going on? There's some sort of mismatch. You just define this thing called a correlation tensor that describes this mismatch. And so you can see in your average space-time, well, maybe this can have some sort of non-trivial dynamics or something like that that you're going to have to worry about. The point being that the correlation tensor must appear in an average space-time just from this consideration. It must be there. How big is it? Is it important at all? The hope would be that it's negligible. It's completely negligible. And this would mean that our average Friedman metric description of things accords with our average Friedman Einstein tensor and stress energy tensor description of things. And so it's all nice and consistent, and you know, we have no nasty surprises creeping in there to mimic things that you know, to mimic other effects.
Is it always the case that relation always holds for any space time to follow conditions under which the equality is true?
Yeah, sure. So a trivial one in fact is just a perfect Friedman universe. Okay, so because it's invariant under your spatial averaging procedure, this just all falls out. But as soon as you introduce any inhomogeneity, it pretty much goes away. So the important question is not whether it's there or not. There is back reaction to some extent, because this thing must exist if you really truly believe in an average description of space-time. The question is, does it matter at all? Is it completely negligible? And you hope that it is. So just to come up with some sort of concrete averaging procedure that we can play with, let's look at scalar averaging. So we're going to forego all this issue of trying to covariantly average tensor quantities and just look at scalars, because you can get quite far with scalars, it turns out. And let's just average them over some space-like hypersurface. This is just the determinant of your spatial metric here. Okay, this is foliation dependent, but it's covariant at least. So it gives us something. So immediately what you can see is time evolution doesn't commute with your spatial average, because if you push a time derivative through here, you see, well, you get the time derivative of this as you want, but you're also going to get a time derivative of your spatial metric as well.
Is
Go.
It, is the converse true that time averaging doesn't commute with spatial evolution, with spatial gradients?
I don't know. I mean, you can imagine just flipping it around. I mean, what would this term look like just for a time coordinate? Right, and well, I mean, it's not, I mean, if that depends on space as well, then yeah, it's true.
Sorry, what's the question?
So,
if a time average commutes with spatial evolution.
What do you mean by spatial evolution?
Like
spatial gradients.
Yeah, K.
What is the spatial evolution?
Gradient is by the same as evolution.
Oh,
evolution is time evolution.
Okay, I mean gradients.
A change in some spatial quantity. Well, so I guess the answer is maybe it would, depending on, you know, the form of the determinant of your time-like part, which could or could not depend on spatial coordinates, depending on your space-time. In general, though, because we have an expanding universe, in this case, I mean, your spatial determinant here is going to depend on time. Unless you're in a static universe, which is, you know, you're looking at relatively trivial systems there. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, you can write down your average Freeman and Ray-Chowdhury equations, and you get this extra correction term due to stuff like this going on. The way it's written down here is maybe a bit suggestive. So you see here, it's an additive term like lambda. Actually, this has a sign, so it's not strictly additive. But it can maybe give you acceleration. So this is what a lot of people are talking about when they say they're looking at back reaction results. They're looking at an effective acceleration term in the Ray-Chowdhury equation that's due to, you know, something like this. Okay, so I've actually suppressed a bunch of terms here. It just bundles together mostly terms like this. So actually, sorry, this theta, I should say, is the expansion scalar. So I'm mostly working here in terms of a 1 plus 3 decomposition around some like dust congruence. So you get a bunch of quantities like this theta, the expansion scalar, that's to do with the expansion of your congruence. And you also have from like the right-hand side of your field equations, things like the density and the pressure. So there are a bunch of terms like that in there.
If you remember correctly, QD is a difference of variance of delta theta and a variance of shear, basically. So if you want to subtract it from the...
No, just the mean of the shear squared with a numerical factor in front of it.
The same as the variance, but shear is zero.
Oh, yeah, sure, okay, that's fine.
But I guess what maybe you should mention is that it actually vanishes for linear. So
that's
I mean,
my question overall. I mean, this whole averaging thing and the debates about it, would that all go away if we assume just metric? We don't have to assume about the density. The metric, the linear perturbation for metric holds together.
So we're going to come to that very soon, actually. But as well as that, there are actually some more general terms in this that I didn't want to show as well. Like you can worry about things like the four acceleration. You also get some averages of your pressure and stuff like that. So there's a bunch of stuff in here. But the point is, like, to give you the positive contribution that you want if you're trying to construct some accelerating model, you mostly just want the variance of the expansion scalar, which in Friedman is just the Hubble rate times 3. This is the term you want to worry about the most. It's not 100% strictly true, but that's normally what people are playing with.
Can calculate based on perturbation that you know exists, but in fact, if you just plug in, calculate that to quadratic order is zero, and I mean that's the simple calculation. And then you probably have to go to higher order to get that.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that shortly. Yeah.
The other thing is this set of equations
is
closed.
Yeah. So you actually also need to come up with some closure relation. So you know we're grasping around in the dark a bit with this back reaction stuff. Okay, so back to this acceleration question. Well, you know, let's use these equations to try and come up with something that gives us something that looks like acceleration. Using, for example, this, you know, let's come up with a model that has a really high variance of the expansion rate, for example. You'd only expect this to be important where nonlinearities are important, of course, because, well, if you're in the linear regime, you expect these deviations from the mean expansion rate to be small. Okay. This can maybe help you solve the coincidence problem. So you only get this back reaction term due to this variance when you enter the nonlinear regime. So this is another statement that people have been trying to make, sort of tying the appearance of this effective acceleration to the appearance of nonlinear structure formation. And people have been showing this with numerous toy models. So is back reaction important is still the question. So just to give you a very brief overview of a few studies, some people say yes. So they take averages of these spherically symmetric LTB models, for example, and they find, yep. So you get some acceleration of this scalar average. Well, an important question there is, what are you trying to represent by averaging a completely inhomogeneous model? Why are you fitting a smooth homogeneous solution to something that just clearly isn't? It's not even statistically homogeneous. Okay, so it does give you this acceleration term, but it's not really clear what the average means in that case. So people look at things like Swiss cheese models, where you match lots of LTB regions to an external Freeman-Robinson-Walker solution. You make sure they're properly embedded in this, like you solve the junction conditions and all of that sort of thing. So it forms a global solution over your whole space-time. And, well, it turns out that these things mostly tend to have negligible back reaction, like below the 10 to the minus 4 level, which means, you know, it's not dark energy or anything like that. The problem here is, well, you've sort of, in some sense, assumed closeness to Freeman-Robertson-Walker. You've sort of taken on the Freeman-Robertson-Walker symmetries on large scales to some extent. Is that really what you're trying to do? Or, you know, is there a more general approach you could try? So onto the perturbation theory aspect of things, you can look at this perturbatively. So you have some Freeman-Robertson-Walker background, you perturb around it, and then you can do things like splitting your small scale and long wavelength modes from each other and inspecting what happens to the small scale modes as they tend towards the nonlinear regime. So correct me if I'm wrong about this. but the basic result is that in terms of any sort of back reaction effect, so any effect that these small wavelength modes can have on your background metric, these guys have shown that you just get something that looks like gravitational waves and not acceleration. So just from perturbative considerations alone, you don't get any back reaction. Except these guys say you do. So they try this alternative expansion scheme based on rather than expanding in things like perturbations of your metric, you expand in gradients of the spatial metric. And when they do this, they find quite reliably for sensible standards Gaussian anisotropic initial conditions, when you evolve this forward, you get this 5 to 10% level back reaction effect. So what's going on here? There's clearly a mismatch. Well, one of the things that seems to be happening with this thing is you can actually rewrite these perturbative gradient terms in terms of first and second orders in your regular cosmological perturbation theory. And what actually seems to be happening is linear order in the gradient expansion is mixing first and second order cosmological perturbation terms. Okay, so you're keeping some of the second order perturbations in. Not all of them, but some of them. Okay, so again, it's not really clear what's happening here. Would it matter if you went to infinite order in your cosmological?
Mm-hmm. Averaging depends on the choice of foliation.
So yeah, sure. So they do pick a foliation, but it's just a standard 1 plus 3 decomposition around your dust congruence again. So
if that's...
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Which is a relatively natural choice.
No, but that is actually the pathology. I mean, that's a pathological choice, because as soon as things go nonlinear, then that foliation breaks down.
So is the perturbative approach valid?
So this is another question, right? Is the perturbative approach valid? Because we're seeing this mismatch here. It clearly depended on the order of your perturbative expansion. It's not clear to me.
Definition has broken down.
Potentially, yeah. They don't seem to mention this too much in here. And
but if that is the source of foliation, then that is, I mean, that's not going to work.
Okay. Well, it's maybe worth a closer look at this paper. Okay, so what's the answer? Well, you know, people saying no, back reaction is negligible, maybe relying on perturbative analyses, as you're saying, like up to linear order in perturbation theory, we don't get this acceleration effects, at least. Or they're looking at toy models with lots of symmetry, maybe this symmetry is breaking things as well, maybe it's an unnatural imposition on the problem. And then you have the same problems from the yes, back reaction is important camp as well. You either have unrealistic models or models that don't really represent the statistically homogeneous universe, or you have things that, you know, like the scalar averaging thing, you're not really calculating an observable there. You're just sort of applying some mathematical procedure. You're not looking at what's happening to observables at all. So does it actually mean anything to what we observe? Okay, so can we find a back reaction model that is in some sense non-perturbative? Can we look for exact solutions? We don't have to rely on perturbation theory. You know, we just get a nice exact answer where, you know, we don't need to worry that our perturbations are under control or anything like that. Can we look at models that are statistically homogeneous in some sense? So we know that, well, we at least don't have to confront the issue of the average not being meaningful. And can we look at observables? Like, does this actually give you an observable effect, like, say, the having fainter type 1a supernovae? I'm going to say yes, because we have our own toy model. So one way of thinking about this is to just start with a bunch of alternately expanding and collapsing Freeman-Robertson-Walker regions. So this is familiar to those of you who know about the spherical collapse model, for example. You're doing a sort of broadly similar thing. What happens if you send a light ray through those alternating, expanding and collapsing regions? Well, you get something like this. As you go through an expanding region, I should just point out here, this is the normal supernova distance modulus, normalized to the distance modulus that you get in a vacuum.
So you're saying your dark matter is going through itself?
This is purely just a perfectly homogeneous and isotropic Friedmann model. There are no perturbations or anything like that. It's just a dust-only Einstein-De Sitter model, and then, say, a Milne vacuum model, for example. And the Einstein-De Sitter model is collapsing. Okay, this is a toy. Yep, so this is, right, so I'll explain that now. See these sections here? This is just your normal decelerating or evolution as you go through the vacuum model. It doesn't have to be vacuum, it could be, you know, something else, but it's an expanding model. And then these, they look like it's discontinuous. Actually, that's only an artifact of being in this distance modulus space. If you look at the luminosity distance, you don't have this issue. It's continuous. It doesn't have a continuous first derivative. Just think of it as I'll skip forward one. Just imagine you have a bunch of cubes, right? And you just care about one line of sight. You're just modeling single lines of sight for now.
How these came about is relevant.
No. This is purely a toy just to motivate what I'm going to say. No. So, yeah. So at the moment, I'm just concentrating on what the optical effect is of going through alternating, collapsing, and expanding regions. This is not a global solution of the field equations. You're probably worried about things like matching and stuff like that. Great. Don't worry about that just yet. We'll talk about that very shortly. Okay. But the point being, as you go through this model, you know, decelerating region, you go down on this plot, you have a negative gradient. Collapsing region, the collapsing region is actually also dynamically decelerating, but observationally, you go up, you sort of go backwards, you get this blue shift, so you go back in Z here. And so you get this sort of pattern like this. And the point here is that you see it has this overall upward trend. So you can imagine if you smooth this somehow, you'd have something that, in a very coarse-grained way, looks like acceleration, if you observe supernova here, for example. But locally, everywhere you look, in every bit of that composite space-time, it's decelerating everywhere. There's no lambda or anything here. It's decelerating everywhere locally. This is purely an optical effect. Okay? So the overall observed trend looks like acceleration. Because you have all these disjoint regions that are collapsing or expanding as well, you actually have quite a large variance in your Hubble rate. So hopefully you can see where I'm going with this. This is a model that, if you averaged it, would give you a non-trivial back reaction in this scalar averaging formalism. Okay, but this isn't a global solution of the field equations. These are completely disjoint. They don't satisfy junction conditions across the boundary. But you can construct models that do. So again, I'm really going to strongly point out here, this is a toy model. I'm not saying the real universe is like this in any way. It's just to sort of probe what sort of effects you can get, and also the link between this observable effect and your back reaction. So if you have this anisotropic Kastner vacuum solution, you can uniquely match it to a pure Einstein de Sitter Friedman model at this boundary. So these have been called cheese slice models, because everything has to be about cheese in homogeneous cosmologies for some reason.
These are planar?
These are planar. And what we're interested in doing here is modeling a single line of sight which runs orthogonal to the planes. So you can see what's going to happen here. We're going through this collapsing Einstein de Sitter model. We're going to get a blue shift. Then we enter this Kastner region, which is a vacuum region that's expanding along the line of sight direction. And we're going to get an equivalent vacuum type evolution of the distance redshift relation. Okay, this is nice because you exactly match the junction conditions on the boundary. This is a full, exact, non-perturbative global solution of the field equations built up of these different models. And it's statistically homogeneous. Okay, you just pick the same sizes for each of these regions, for example. So on a given space-like hypersurface, you'd find that, on average, it looks the same everywhere, above the scale corresponding to, let's call this a unit cell. Okay? So we have this exact solution. What do the observations look like? So what you can see here, it's a bit faint. Can everyone
see it? Yeah.
No, it turns out not to be. You can play with that a lot depending on your initial conditions and stuff like that. You can choose things like the initial volume of each of the regions, the initial expansion rate, stuff like that. But you do end up getting constraints like you need the expansion rates in a perpendicular direction along the interface to match. So you have a few free variables to play with, but there are some constraints there as well. So you can play with that stuff.
It's basically one-dimensional in the sense mm-hmm. that
Yeah. So you could ray trace out in the other directions, but of course, if you go perpendicular to what I'm calling the line of sight, then you're just going to be in collapsing Einstein de Sitter, or you're just going to be in Kastner. Yes, in some sense. So let's look at what observations we'd get out of this model. Again, considering we're just looking in one line of sight direction. And this is what these green lines are that are a little bit faint, unfortunately. But what we've done is just averaged a bunch of lines of sight at different starting positions throughout this unit cell. So we've got what an average observer would see. And this is why you see these variance bands as well. And you see, if you look out to very small redshifts, well, you're probably still within the same unit cell that you started out in. And so there's, you're not really probing the statistical homogeneity scale of your region yet. So you get these big errors. As you get further out, it converges to something sensible. So again, this is in terms of this distance modulus. Positive gradient means something that looks like acceleration. Negative gradient looks like deceleration. You can see it looks like it's accelerating on average. We also have this black dashed line here, and this is sort of taken from the luminosity distance that you would see if you took the scalar average, the dynamical scalar average of your spacetime, and made a Friedman model out of that. So you calculate the deceleration parameter of your scalar average, which of course doesn't care about light rays or photons or anything, it's just this purely dynamical thing on a space-like hypersurface. You just calculate Q naught, H naught in that, and then you draw the distance redshift relation you would get in the equivalent Friedman model. That's this black dashed line. They kind of match, which is interesting, right? This is suggesting that the actual observations, you know, this is, we're not really doing any sort of weird back reaction type averaging stuff here with these green lines. These are just observations averaged over some ensemble. Yeah. It's actually the log of the luminosity distance with some other stuff. This just corresponds to what the supernova people typically plot. It's a bit nicer because it's normalized with respect to a reference model. So you can tell positive gradient means acceleration, etc. Okay, where was I? Yeah, so you know we have these observational quantities that look like they're accelerating. They have nothing to do with this scalar averaging or this back reaction type thing. But then we do have this scalar average thing that's just the dynamics, doesn't care about observations, and miraculously they match up, almost. So what's that telling us? I should also point out, if you just look at the local quantities. So for example, you just look at things like the expansion scalar or the Ray-Chowdhury equation locally at each point in space-time. Everywhere in space-time, that's decelerating. In principle, maybe you could try and measure something like the expansion of a dust congruence very locally, but it's certainly nothing anyone's ever really observed. We're used to measuring null geodesics, right? That's normally what we measure. Okay, but so the point is, this is a sort of demonstration of a non-perturbative, statistically homogeneous exact solution where we get an observable back reaction effect. Okay, so yeah, that's kind of interesting. So there are some failures of this model, of course, as well. So as you pointed out, it's quite anisotropic. It looks nothing at all like the real universe, really, apart from the fact that it's statistically homogeneous. So I guess the question is, where does this leave back reaction? Is it important? It's still kind of hard to say. My gut feeling is that it's not going to give us acceleration. You really have to try very hard to come up with something very contrived to even give you a sort of sensible acceleration. Just in terms of the model I've just shown you, thinking of what parameters I'd have to tune to give you the lambda CDM observations, it would be silly. It would be ridiculously fine-tuned, and I wouldn't believe it. It doesn't give you anything natural. So I don't think it's, you know, a solution to the cosmological constant problem or anything like that. But that's not to say it's definitely completely negligible. There's clearly still some wiggle room here. And the important thing isn't to look at, say, these perturbative analyses, perhaps. It's to look at these non-perturbative effects. They might be giving us small corrections that we don't know about yet. So how do you get a handle on that? Ideally, you construct more realistic exact solutions, ones that actually correspond to a realistic universe. I don't know how to do that. It's really difficult. The best way forward that I can see is to look at full GR simulations. There's actually an interesting result that shows that you're never going to get any back reaction in a Newtonian n-body simulation. All of the back reaction terms just end up falling out onto the boundary. Because you have periodic boundary conditions, they vanish. This doesn't happen in GR. It's a completely different, it's an initial value problem. And so your back reaction terms don't vanish magically like that. But, well, who's going to do me a full GR inhomogeneous cosmological simulation?
Is only specific to that definition of back reaction.
Yes. Yes,
there are other ways of defining it. I bet what you calculated, that actually there would be an Newtonian effect. I have to side pick. I'm not sure. Mm. But
yeah.
I mean, I think the effect that you're looking for, that the model that you have, I think at the Newtonian level, you will see the same effect.
Maybe we'll discuss this after. I'm not sure about that. But okay. Another way of looking at this is maybe go to higher order perturbation theory. So how much of a masochist are you? And you're still not going to get a definitive result necessarily either. If this is truly something non-perturbative going on, it might just completely drop out altogether from your perturbative expansion. There are observational things we can do to, you know, just consistency checks to try and see if anything like this is going on. A particularly neat one is to look for curvature mismatches. It turns out that in some ways of formulating this back reaction problem, you can get different types of spatial curvature. So, you know, the normal omega k that we know and love, depending on whether you're looking at the dynamics of the space-time or observables in the space-time. And so this is what Clarkson and some others did. You see you have this dynamical omega k and this geometric omega k from your observations. They come up with a toy model to probe this, and then they try and constrain it with various CMB, supernova data, H-naught measurements and stuff like that. And depending on exactly which combination of data sets they use, maybe you get a sort of slight detection of these two things being away from zero. Doesn't really work so well. And you also have this degeneracy that they aren't really able to break either. I don't know, I'm not really sure what to make of this, but it is a potential signature that you could try and look for. And the nice thing is it's kind of easy because you just put two different omega k's in there. It's completely phenomenological. So maybe that's a way forward as well. Or you can just not worry about it. I don't know. That seems dangerous.
In space distance luminosity?
Yeah, so as far as I remember, it depends on where it enters various quantities. So if it enters through the Hubble rate, they say that's the dynamical omega k. If it enters through your geodesic equation, your null geodesic equation, then it's geometric. That's the distinction. Yeah, exactly. But like I said, it's just a phenomenological thing to play with. But it's neat because you can actually constrain something. It's just, again, you have an interpretation issue. What does it mean if you do detect that they're different? Okay, so I'll wrap up. The takeaway from this, I guess, is that we currently assume homogeneity. We don't really know that the universe is homogeneous. I mean, it seems pretty good. It seems to work out, but we don't know. And so my personal feeling is that we should at least try and test it. We should try and test the Copernican principle. You know, it's probably going to come out right, but you never know. There are always surprises, and it's good to be rigorous. The other nice thing is, I mean, some of these tests will actually just come as a byproduct of other future cosmological tests as well. So it's not necessarily a huge effort that will be required. The next thing is that observations off our past light cone powerful as well. They break a bunch of degeneracies. And there's maybe a bunch of other interesting stuff going on inside our past light cone as well that we can play with. It's kind of a pretty fresh field. The data aren't really good enough yet, but pretty soon they're going to be good enough. We're going to get, for example, KSC catalogs. In 2030, we're going to get spectral distortion measurements, that sort of thing. So there's maybe stuff to be done there as well. And the other thing is, as in my opinion at least, the back reaction issue still hasn't been settled. I still don't think it's really compelling, But I think there is an argument for the fact that back reaction is there. The term is there if you believe there's some mapping between the real inhomogeneous universe and your background homogeneous model. But the question is still, is that big or not? And my personal feeling is that it's not big, but maybe it's not negligible. Okay, so thanks.
So I guess just one last point. So I don't think anybody claims that there is no back reaction. Everybody says there would be. I answered a question that non-linear, so there is some back reaction.
Yeah.
The only statement is that if you do your best estimate on how big the back reaction is, based on what we know about our universe, it's a very small amount, something like 10 to the minus 5 or so, or depending on observable, obviously. But over the large distances, like redshift of 1 or so, it's something like 10 to the minus 5. And the scale of it is something like grad phi squared divided by h squared, which is which is, as I said, is 10 to the minus 5 based on the scale of the power squared. But in your model, of course, you build the toy model, so you can build the toy model where grad phi squared is of order h squared. And the question is, so then that means that it doesn't mean that it's a non-perturbative effect. It's just that you made perturbations so big that you see their effect basically on the background. So
okay, so I mean, and maybe that's the point that...
And maybe that's one thing you want to calculate is that basically, as I said, estimates of the order of the back reaction is grad phi squared over h squared. So you can just look at your model and see if that's of order one. So if it is, then it's not, that's exactly what you expect from perturbative analysis.
Okay. But then I guess the question is, well, so you've partially addressed this, so is a perturbative analysis good enough? And what you're saying is we have a model where the perturbations will essentially be breaking down right there. That's a good description.
Right.
Yeah. So, but does that happen in our real universe? And that's an important question, I feel. And how do you know it's not happening in our real universe?
Yeah, I mean, it's based on Copernican principle.
Yeah,
so,
sure. So we're
So another question is that given that the Copernican principle basically led to all of science in the past 5 centuries, why should we give it up now?
Well, the Einstein de Sitter model did really well for a long time, and all of a sudden that doesn't work anymore. I mean,
models have come and gone, but the Copernican principle is basically what started science. I mean, you could have said that, okay, laws of physics here, there, and Andromeda, and half a century are very different from each other. So you, at any point you could have said, okay, so there is a certain prediction that doesn't fit certain observation, is that the laws of physics there is different than
question of the domain of application.
Well, but then we're saying that it's worked for 5 centuries. Models have come and gone, but Copernican principle has stayed.
I don't think longevity is a good reason to keep a theory around necessarily. I mean, if it hasn't been tested, this is the point I really want to make. It's a wonderful working assumption. We'd be really stuck without some form of Copernican principle.
I mean,
you wouldn't be able to do CMB physics.
But the question is, are you doing science anymore if you don't assume Copernican principle?
And the point is, well, you're trying to test it. You're being an empiricist about it.
Yeah. Classical physics work for 2 centuries.
Okay, let's
philosophy.
Well, I just wanted to make the comment that you said that we haven't actually tested statistical homogeneity, which I don't agree with. So there's a number of measurements of galaxy clustering, which you mentioned very briefly. We do now have tests of statistical homogeneity at scales of 5 parsecs with galaxy surveys.
So that's assuming a background model to some extent, though. Isn't that the case? Don't you need distance measures to be able to...
That's true, but it's,
well,
I guess, a consistency test, so it's very
definitely
hard to explain how you can measure statistical homogeneity to such a high degree in an inhomogeneous model where you incorrectly assume the FLW to so I guess it's just a consistency test. But
so I guess, and the fact that this thing does come out, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, these are statistical homogeneity scale, a lot of the results seem to be coming out higher than we'd naively expect as well, or has that result gone away? The scale of homogeneity is on larger scales than we thought. I've heard some of those results. Maybe I'm wrong.
No,
your face says I am.
so there's 22 groups. So there's a more controversial group of researchers who prefer prefer not to use any information about the selection function of galaxy surveys. They reject that we can understand the selection function, and they will want to measure these really high scales of homogeneity.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take into account everything we know about the selection function of galaxy surveys, then you get a result that's completely within the parameters again.
Okay. So and so I guess the thing to take away from that is it's a consistency test. I mean, obviously, if you sort of pull the Lambda CDM rug out from under this sort of test, then it's not really clear what would happen. Like, would you still be testing homogeneity? I'm not sure if that's the case, which is why I didn't talk about them too much. But certainly, if you do assume you're close to Friedman, then yeah. This is measurements of the fractal dimension of your galaxy distribution line. Yeah. So it's a consistency test, let's say.
I think we should stop there before we thank Phil again. So we'll be going for dinner in the bistro.